We're glad you're joining us here at Common Thread Online. This is a recording of our community gathering, as we do each week, to think together about the spiritual journey. At the end of the lesson, we open the floor for discussion. We'd love to hear what you're thinking, too. Go to our community's Facebook page, post your thoughts. So, let's begin today with a story. You've probably heard me say it 1,000 times. Everything starts with stories. Meaning-making stories, once they settle deep inside of us, determine what we look for. And when we are looking in this area and not that area, we're going to find the things that are here and not the things that are there. Our stories determine what we do, and our stories determine what we avoid doing. Everything begins with a story. And this story starts with a scientist who worked first at UC Santa Barbara and then moved to MIT. And she started with a very simple story, and her story was, nature is wise. Nature has had millions of years to figure things out, and so nature is wise, and we ought to listen to nature and learn from nature. As most core stories go, that one's pretty simple, kind of elegant. But once that is the starting narrative, then that determines what you look for, which determines what you find. It determines where you look. It determines what you do, and it determines what you avoid doing. This is kind of a fun book. It's called The Age of Living Machines. It's about the synthesis of both biology and engineering and kind of what's happening on the frontiers of science these days. And her story figures in this book, if you start your story with nature is wise, then it might, as it did, lead you to ask the question, what do abalones know about hardness? What do abalones know about hardness? Now, who thinks those kinds of questions unless you start with a beginning narrative that says nature is wise? So maybe abalones have some wisdom about hardness. Well, it turns out that abalones stitch together their shells from the most abundant resources in their immediate environment, non-toxic materials that are present in every moment of their waking lives, calcium, carbon, and oxygen. What they do is they connect these molecules together, calcium carbonate, and they create a very weak solid, and that solid, we know it as chalk. So that's what they do, is they stitch together molecules and they make chalk. But chalk isn't very hard. Chalk isn't very strong. So in a surprise second move, now abalones stitch together two fields of science that we don't typically stitch together, materials science and biology. Because what they do is they start stitching those molecules together with those inorganic compound molecules with an organic compound that's a string of proteins. And when they do that, they take this rather fragile solid and they make it 3,000 times more strong. And not only does it have the strength to, that's pound per pound, as strong as steel, but it's also flexible enough that it doesn't crack. There it is, a product as strong as steel without any toxic byproducts. When the abalone dies after 25 or 30 years, all of those molecules return back into the environment to then be used again by the next generation of abalones. So that has a lot to say about how we ought to be thinking about our materials. What ought we be using to build our buildings, and how might we be shaping them? And so you would think that this discovery some 25 years ago would have blossomed into a whole new realm of inquiry and a whole new realm of science, except that the concept faced some resistance in the materials industry because it starts with a story that says nature is wise, and most material scientists start with a different story. Material scientists go to different classes when they are in school than biologists. They don't go to the same classes, so they don't pick up the same story. The nature is wise story kind of shows up in the biology classes, but in the material sciences classes, it's more of a dig it up and refine it kind of story. And so depending on how your story starts, will depend upon what you look for and what you find, what you accept and what you reject, what goes into your mind and integrates quite seamlessly, or what your mind rebels against. Stories inform what we look for. Stories inform what we explore. And as a result, stories inform what we stumble onto, abalone shells and hardness, who knew, because they determine what we look for. So, stories are powerful. And what we are talking about together is the core stories of ultimacy. When we talk about expanding the way that we imagine God, we're talking about accessing different, broader, wider experiences, because we start with a different, broader, wider beginning narrative. I said during our guided meditation this morning that we can imagine God in many different ways, as a song or a gravity or breath or a soil in which we grow. And when that happens, we don't just change how we imagine God, we change the places that we look for sacred experience or spiritual experience. We change the way we walk on the spiritual journey. And we've been talking about imagining God shot through everything, every experience, following up on what Ignatius told us and what's rooted in our scriptures, that we can find God in all things. The first week, we looked at one of the common places that happens, finding God in the woods. Then the next week, we looked at another common place that it happens, finding God in the garden. And today, we're going to talk about finding God in our people. So I asked some people in the church if they had a story that they could tell. Tell me a story, my email said, about finding God in our people. And a couple of folks wrote back and said, Doug, that is really a tough question, because you've been talking about God as a verb. And that is really just messing with my head, because it's really hard to imagine what it is you're talking about. So I hear people say things like God moments, and I've got a little problem with that, because I've got this construct in my head, and I've got this construct in my head, and I know that what we're doing is really tweaking all of the assumptions we have about things that we've inherited from a long time ago. We're trying to get our heads around the notion that God is experience as much as God is a being in the sky. And that's just tough. But nevertheless, several wrote back, I still have a story. So let me tell it to you. And here's one of them. One of the people that wrote back, a woman in our community, said, I am in a group with several people, and they've become dear to me, but one woman in particular has become especially dear. And part of that is probably because our personalities are so much alike. We think in the same patterns. We have the same kinds of struggles. We respond to, we react to situations the same way. And I swear, when I see the things that she does, or when I hear her report the way that she's thinking, it's like seeing myself in the mirror, because I think, oh man, I do that. Oh man, I think that way. In fact, she said, sometimes when I see her doing things and thinking things, they're the same kinds of things that I do and I think. And when I do them or when I think them, I sometimes beat myself up for doing and thinking the things that I see her doing also. But here's the thing, she said. This woman has become very dear to me. I have come to love this woman deeply. That thing you've been talking about, the way that the mystics say you can't really know something until you agape that something, until you are connected to, and yet that's what has happened to me. I stumbled into a deep sense of love and acceptance for her. I begin to experience in that the fruit of the spirit that we talk about. There is joy in that experience. There is peace and patience and kindness in that experience. And then when she talks about her flaws, which, by the way, are also my flaws, she said, I have started the experience of realizing a deeper truth. They just don't matter that much. They're just not that big a deal. Sure, problems are problems, and sure, they cause problems. And, you know, we look at our problems that cause problems, and we think, oh, yeah, it's a problem. But she said, it just doesn't matter. But she said, here was the thing that really made me think sacred or divine or spiritual. You know, what's happened is the way that I now see her, I've begun to be able to see myself that same way. What has happened is as I have been able to experience this sacredness, this divine movement experience, I am able to see myself with the same kind of, you know, those things are just not that big a deal that I see her with. And I'm able to reciprocate that even to myself. She used the phrase, seeing myself with divine eyes. It's true for me as it is true as I've experienced with her. My own flaws, they're a deal. They're just not that big a deal. Love and acceptance, those things apply to me as well. So that's a thing. I think, she didn't say this, but I think this woman got a glimpse of that Bible verse that we probably memorized if you ever went to Sunday school, God is love. Because at some point we start to realize that whatever the divine is, this thing that we can't pin down, whatever the sacred is, whatever the spiritual is, that love thing is so in the mix that, yeah, there are flaws, but they're just not that important. Yeah, they create pain. They do. But they don't define our reality. And this person was able to say, what I have been able to experience in my love for another, I now realize comes to me as well. Here's a core story you hear at Common Thread all the time. Everything is connected. Very simple, very elegant. Everything is connected. We are, every one of us, made of the same essence, divine breath or divine essence. We are more one than we are two. Now, we have this very strong illusion, the illusion of a self. And when we create that illusion of self, we create these boundaries around it. Maybe it's our skin boundaries, the boundaries of our body. Maybe it's the boundaries of who I think I am. And that illusion constantly tells us that we are divided, not connected, that we are two, we are not one. It's a powerful illusion because, as I've said many times, I can move my arm, I can't move Bob's arm. So I must be a separate entity over here. But our mystics keep telling us you just have to look at it from a slightly different angle. And you will see that the whole concept of a self is an illusion. We being many, Paul said, are one. We being many are one body. Now, if that starting point that is counterintuitive because that persistent illusion, if that becomes our starting narrative and it settles deep inside of it, it's going to change what we look for. And when it changes what we look for, it's going to change what we find. We start looking where we never would have for the spiritual journey version of abalone shell hardness. We experience the divine in different ways because we start looking in different places. Now, in this lesson, I've been talking about making sure that we don't ignore the wisdom of the language of our bodies. That's one of the ways that we can do what Ignatius told us, we can find God in all things. In our meditation this morning, I asked you to think about where it was in your body that you feel divine movement with your people. Where do you sense love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness? Where does that happen? How does it happen? As a way of alerting us to when it is happening and us having that construct to say, ah, I am in the flow of that spiritual, that sacred moment. How does that happen when you're with those that you love and who love you, or those you cooperate with, those who are cooperating with you, those that you share this little bit of earth, those times you catch the glimpses of the image of God in one another? Because our tradition insists that this is one of the contexts in which we do experience in our bodies, feelings in our bodies that we've come to define as both deeply human and deeply spiritual, deeply divine. When we are in life with one another, when we are in spiritual community with one another, maybe something as simple as being on a softball team with one another, or cooperating, or problem solving, or resolving conflict, every day kinds of experiences with our people are the territory of sacred experience. Everyday experiences are the territory of the divine experience, if we are looking, if we are seeing, if we are listening. What Jesus said, eyes that see, ears that hear. So we have to make a distinction between principle and application. Here's the principle. We are more one than two. Here's the principle, oneness. Here's the principle, everything is connected. Here's the application, togetherness, community, belonging. The principle is a story. The principle is an idea. The principle is a concept. Everything is connected. You and I, we are more one than we are two. The application of the principle gets worked out in everyday life. We have a feeling in our bodies, the application of the principle. We sense divine movement in love and joy and peace in these everyday settings, in these contexts that we inhabit together. We experience togetherness. We experience belonging. I mentioned some in as we were looking at some of the other places experience people experience the divine in all things in the last few weeks. As more and more people cannot find a spiritual home or an authentic way of being spiritual in organized religion, on a parallel track, we're seeing an awakening to the sacredness of the soil. We don't use the word sacred. Most people don't even think in those terms. We just know that we feel closer to the soil. There is something that we experience when we have our connectedness to the earth. Maybe it happens in the rise of gardening that is going on or urban farming that's going on. Our connection that happens at farmers markets or when we track where our food comes from. We want it to be local. We want it to be sustainable. And I suggested, though most people don't see the correlation between the decline of finding the sacred in organized religion and the rise of finding that in soil and walking in nature and those kinds of things, there is nevertheless a correlation. When we can't have this deep spiritual hunger inside of us met in a construct that isn't working for us anymore, we find a place. And it turns out the places that we find are our places. Our tradition tells us you can find God in the woods, and you can find God in the soil and the rhythm of growing things. And one of the places that we find our place is in belonging. You've probably seen the rise of interest in genealogy lately. There's 23andMe, and there's Ancestry.com. There's a show on PBS I like to watch. It's called Finding Our Roots. They do a genealogical search of some famous person, and what strikes me as I'm watching that is how often people cry when they find out who their people are and where they came from. Because we do this, I think, because we're looking for a sense of place, a sense of belonging. As religious communities get more and more fragmented, as neighborhoods and workplaces and schools, and even as our national identity gets more and more fragmented, it's quite natural that we would find a place to feed that deep spiritual hunger of place, that deep spiritual hunger for belonging. I don't think that most people who are interested in genealogy are thinking of it as a spiritual need. I think rarely could anyone articulate the principle that everything is connected. There's oneness is greater, a better description of reality than two-ness. We just find ourselves mailing off some spit because we're looking for our people. We're looking to find where we belong. We do the same thing online where we're getting part of an affinity group, the kinds of people who are interested in the kinds of things that we're interested in looking to belong, because there is a principle, and it's an important principle. It's a story that we are one. We are one with the divine. We are one with one another. We are one with the earth, with the rocks and the trees. But we get so distracted by that persistent illusion of two-ness that we ignore a most basic component of humanness, spiritualness. And consequently, we feel deeply disconnected because that two-ness story, it's powerful. But if it isn't true, doesn't matter how powerful it is, it can't but mislead us. It can't but distract us from these bigger truths, these divine truths that we can experience in our bodies and we can experience with one another. Without a oneness story settling deep inside of us, we will not look for the essential applications that we need to experience the divine in this context. If we don't let that deep story settle inside of us, it is inevitable that our instincts will betray us. We will avoid, or we will devalue, or we will minimize those places and those practices that we go to apply the principle of oneness. The principle is oneness. The application is belonging. And belonging is a deep need inside of us that compels us and draws us like a gravitational pull toward the principle, toward oneness. It's how we get to the oneness principle. Becoming is a basic nutrient of the spiritual life, because becoming, or belonging, is a basic nutrient of the human soul. Again, the principle of oneness, the application belonging, the application togetherness. I was listening to something Brené Brown wrote. It was either a book or it was an interview that she did. I can't remember. And she said something along the lines of, you can never really lose belonging because we just do belong. We are inextricably connected one to another. We do belong, and you can't ever make that not be so. Nothing we do or doesn't or don't do changes that we belong. It's like the electromagnetic principle of our properties of matter. It just exists. It is. Belonging just is. But what we can do, she said, and what we often do, is we lose sight of that. We lose sight of our belonging. We get caught up so much in our illusions of division, our illusions of separateness, our not togetherness, that we don't experience what always is. And at that point, does it really matter that that is the truth? Does it really matter that that's what is? It doesn't if we don't experience it. So we are one. We do belong with one another. We do belong to one another. And inside of us, we know that by that deep, compelling need to belong. The application acts like a homing beacon that keeps drawing us back to our connections to one another, that keeps drawing us back to our sense of oneness, because oneness just is. Belonging just is. There is a deep knowing deep inside. We were created to fit in. We want to be at a place where we are there because we want it, and those who are there want us to be there. We want to fit. We want to be together even though we are different from one another, to be known for who we are and to be accepted for who we are. When our story says oneness just is, what we start to look for is togetherness. When our story begins with oneness just is, we start figuring out how to do that. That's when we begin to figure out what kind of commitments are required for me to experience oneness with my family. What kind of commitments are required of me to have this kind of belonging with my friendships or with my community. We start trying to figure out how to find the image of God in that other person, even though they for the umpteenth time have left us changing the diaper again, and they for the umpteenth time have left us paying the bills again, and here we are loading the dishwasher once again, and for the umpteenth time we're trying to figure out how to resolve a conflict that started when yet again we have been ignored, and yet again we have been devalued, and yet again we have been run over. And when our starting narrative is oneness is a better description of reality than two-ness, then we go into those very difficult, very challenging contexts, and we figure out togetherness. We figure out belonging in those challenging and difficult contexts, because our starting narrative is oneness just is. We go to the hard places, and we work out in those hard places how to do belonging. We go to the hard places and we figure out how, when there are divisions in our society and how there are divisions in our families, how to do belonging. because some deep part of us knows that we are one, and belonging is truth. This is a hard time to do that. This is a difficult moment in history to figure that out. But it all depends on where we start. Is our starting point that we, being many, are one? Or is our starting point no? We're two. You could stay over there. I'll stay over here. Carol told me this story when I asked for stories, and she went to a race that she was training in Savannah. And after Chris heard this race, he said, yeah, I can see how that might be a belonging story in one context. I can also see how this would be very difficult, because he said, if I was that person, it might be embarrassing to me. So you decide if this is a oneness story or an embarrassing story. Anyway, Carol was training for this race down in Savannah, and then when she was in the race, she hurt her knee and she couldn't finish. So there she was waiting for the medical shuttle, and she noticed a guy hanging around there, and he was dressed like Waldo. Now, if you've ever read to a child, odds are you know Waldo. Waldo is the tall, skinny guy in the red and white striped shirt and the red and white striped hat, and he's always got this big, silly grin on. Anyway, here's this guy dressed up like Waldo hanging around the medical shuttle pickup spot until a lady comes by, and then he stops waiting, and he starts running with her. And so the police officer who is manning the shuttle pickup station fills in Carol and says, oh yeah, that guy, he comes every year. And he's always dressed up as a different character, and he waits. And he waits for the last runner to come along, and then he finishes the race with that last runner so that he or she won't be running alone. And so Carol, when she tells me this story, says, what a beautiful human being. This guy is now my new hero. I want to be like that guy. Carol, watching this guy, felt in her body something of that divine movement, because there she saw modeled compassion and care and love, and she was moved. That's a word that we use when we're trying to pin this idea into words of divine experience, moved. Well, when I read the story, I was moved. It's a story that you could feel in your body, because our bodies have a way of sensing nobility, and our bodies have a way of sensing beauty. Our bodies have a way of sensing compassion, the fruit of the Spirit. So here's Waldo living out a story, a principle. And maybe he can name the principle, probably not. Maybe he knows the story, probably not. But the principle is oneness. We are more one than we are two. The application of the principle is that you belong. You belong in this race. You belong here. You belong with people who run faster than you run. You belong. And knowing that you might be telling yourself a story of not belonging, a story that says you're not fast enough, or you're not good enough, or you're not runner-ish enough, I say hogwash. And I say you belong. So I'm going to dress up in a way that makes you laugh so that you can get past this silly I don't belong story. And we're going to run together. Me alongside you, because you and me, we are one, we are not two. And you belong, and I belong, and we belong. Now, that's not a very dramatic story when you think about the whole of the human experience. There are much more dramatic stories about sacrifice and belonging, but this is a simple story. A guy in a costume at a race. But it can be moving because it's rooted in a truth, that oneness is truth, that belonging is truth. And that's one of the places our heritage tells us if we are looking, we can experience God as a verb. That's one of the places our tradition tells us that we can find God in all things. And indwelling Spirit, may that be so, that we experience our own oneness and then we create spaces for others to experience it as well. That we experience our own belonging. But then we create the space where others can belong as well. Be that so as we follow Jesus. Amen. If these recordings help you move forward on your spiritual journey, we hope you'll take an ownership stake in the community and support the health and well-being of the community. You can go to our website, commonthreadchurch.org. The donate button is at the top of the page for your computer's browser, at the bottom of the page for your phones.